Well, it looks like I'm preaching to the choir, so I can go through my slides really fast, because most of you have seen it before. Well, I will start off by pointing out the global challenges that we face in the 21st century. I'm not going to spend any time on it, but as you all know, you've heard about by 2050 what will be the population, but this is by 2030 we'll have 1 degree Celsius rise in temperature, 21% increase in population. Well, we need 50% more food, 50% more energy, 50% for more water, with all the environmental consequences of increased production for food and for energy. Well, Dave Tillman and colleagues called this the food, energy, environment trilemma back in 2009, and I've been using that terminology since then. But bringing the global challenge home, what are the American farmer facing today? What are the major challenges? Well, I'm sure you've seen this or heard about these numbers before. Today's American farmer feeds about 155 people. In 1960, that number was 26. Farmers are getting older, but farms are getting larger. Well, if you look at the average age of a farmer today, it's 59, and it used to be right about 50, just if you look at 1980s, a few decades ago. So the farmers are aging very fast. But they're also feeling the pressure from the public, from consumers, about how do they make the food. So if you look at the Gallup survey from 2015, you will see that the consumers, American public, we are concerned about environmental quality. You can read, you know, the first one is pollution of drinking water, and then of course it goes down, but you can see 55% of the people, the population, thinks that it is a great deal. So people are, generally speaking, concerned about the environmental consequences of farming. Here is another statistics that you've seen before. Small farmers in the U.S. are really struggling to make ends meet. And who is a small farmer? According to USDA definition, anyone with a gross sale $250,000 or less is classified as a small farmer. Well, if you look at the small farms, you can look at the numbers there. Well, don't worry about the different colors of the bars. That's 2015 and 16. Pretty much identical there, but these are recent data from this year. You will see that 87% of all farms in the U.S. will be classified as small farms. 87%. Look at the next one there. I don't have a pointer, unfortunately. But if you look at the, well, if this works, it does not. If you look at the next figure, you will see 80% of them have less than 250 acres. So in order to make income from farming, to make ends meet, you have to be a large farmer. That means you have to make gross sales over $250,000, according to USDA. So small farmers are really, really struggling. So that's one of the main reasons why they are looking for ways to diversify falling crop prices or diversify their farms. So if you look at the soybean and corn prices, two of the most important commodities produced by our farmers, you can look at the price from 1866 all the way through 2012, and you will see that, and this is inflation-adjusted price. It is probably they are still making less than what they made in 1866 from farming. So farmers are getting frustrated. And if you look at the corn and soybean prices this year, it's gone down considerably. Back in 2012, where the data stopped, It was actually $7 per bushel for corn and almost $15 for soybean. Right now it is less than $3 for corn and about $7 for soybean. So they are really struggling. So if you look at why farmers are looking for farm diversification, well, this is one of the main reasons. I would call it reason number one, falling crop prices, the traditional crops that they grow. Here is reason number two, the uncertainty in the farming business. If you look at production, that is corn yield, bushels per acre, if you look at, it's gone up considerably as a result of technological advancements in the U.S. from the 60s all the way through now. But you can see very frequently extreme weather events are really hurting yield. So the yield goes down. So it's very uncertain. Floods one year, then the droughts the next year. So they used to be so infrequent, but in the last maybe two or three decades, they have become so frequent. It's like it's very difficult to depend on your crop for a living anymore. Many of our farmers are struggling with this uncertainty. That's the reason number two for farm diversification. So farmers are looking for sustainable and cost-effective solutions. How can they make ends meet from farming as a business enterprise? Well, can agroforestry be part of the solution? Like I said, I'm preaching to the choir, so we know that can be part of the solution, but it is time to make it mainstream. So if a farm landscape like this, by introducing a few more trees, you can transform that to produce the food and the energy while taking care of the environment. Of course, we know. But we need to make it mainstream. So how much agroforestry is being practiced in the U.S.? If you look at the different land use categories, forest, farmland, pasture, you have a total of 716 million hectares. Agroforestry, you can say maybe 57 million hectares, but that is including all the grazed forests out west. If you subtract that, there goes all the agroforestry we have in the agroforestry down the drain. We will be down to 3 million hectares. That is only less than 0.5% of all the land that we have in production or in different vegetation. Agroforestry would be like less than 0.5%. Otherwise, it's 8% if you add the grazed forest. Keep that in mind, because later on when I show a few other things, I will say subtracting the grazed forest, then you will see the numbers going down. So keep that in mind. So when did we begin farm diversification? Well, if you look back and what the Native Indians did, Native Americans did, well, their farming practices were all diversified farming. Look around, you know, like in any part of the world that you go in and look at their traditional farming practices, they were all, I would say they were all, well, in most places, they were agroforestry practices. So even here in the U.S., that's how our land use practice used to be. But formally, following the Dust Bowl of the 1930s, we intentionally started planting trees on the landscape. Well, 86,000 miles of field windbreaks were planted back then to protect 4 million acres of agricultural land in the Great Plains. So just an example from Nebraska, even right now, over 15,000 miles of field windbreaks are protecting over 1 million acres of crop land. So we were able to bring productivity back to the Great Plains as a result of tree planting. Well, right now, most of these windbreaks are old. Very few are planting the new windbreaks, although it is beneficial. It's well proven, but even the limited windbreaks that we have, they are being ripped off or ripped out because, well, it happened especially in 2010, 11, 12, 13, because the corn, soybean, wheat prices, all the commodity prices were really high. They were trying to plant every inch possible. But there is a major effort right now to really look at all the remaining windbreaks and show the value of these windbreaks again for Great Plains farming systems. So, coming to farm diversification again, I will show you a few examples. What kind of benefits are we talking about when we add trees? Most of the windbreaks trees were perhaps timber species. Some of them were non-timber, but most of them timber species. But there are other potential crops that we could plant as part of a windbreak or as part of alley cropping or as part of riparian buffers that could actually benefit the farmers to make a second or third income from their land. Chinese chestnut is an example, a crop that we work with at the Center for Agroforestry at the University of Missouri. You can make, again, these are gross figures, $6,000 an acre per year, beginning the seventh year. Do you know how much you can make gross by growing corn or soybean? Roughly? Well, maybe if you are lucky, $500 to $1,000. But that is again gross, and keep in mind maybe half of that can be profit. So, but from Chinese chestnut, you can make a profit of perhaps $3,000 an acre a year, if you think of 50% as profit. Pecans, $3,000. Elderberry, $6,000 to $12,000 an acre. So you don't need a 500-acre farm. You may only need perhaps a 50-acre farm to make a living by combining multiple species, especially species of this nature. So these are some of the agroforestry examples from the Midwest. The first one is a Chinese chestnut wheat alley cropping system. And this particular farmer was telling me that his enterprise is now, he only has about 7 acres right now, but he's expanding to about 15 acres. But he's going to have a manager to run the farm at this point. And keep in mind, it is not a 5,000 acre farm. It is maybe at the most a 15 acre enterprise. But he's making enough money to appoint a farm manager at this point as an agroforestry farm, because he is making enough money from his chestnut trees. And the trees are still young, as you can see. And he is, of course, growing wheat, a second crop. The bottom one shows a pecan soybean alley cropping system. Why not? If you are growing a pecan crop, you will see that wide alley in between. Why can't you grow a crop like soybean? So you can see that there are ways, and landowners are adopting these systems at this point, trying to diversify. You may have a major crop like soybean or wheat, but still, you have a few trees per acre providing you a second income. And in some years, like this year, for example, one of the farmers that I talked to in the last 2 weeks told me that he's given up on the soybean crop. Of course, they are harvesting the soybean crop, but the price is so low. He's going to make all his money on a second crop, that is pecan. And this is a farmer who lives not too far from Columbia. So you can see that farmers are really finding it beneficial to have a second or third crop. Benefit of diversifying the farmscape. Well, modern technologies. And these gadgets are already there in place for farming. And agroforestry, as you can see in both those pictures, you can really use conventional equipment if you design it properly. And even when you think about precision farming, well, you can bring that concept to agroforestry also if you plan in specific configurations like this. So they are not mutually exclusive. A lot of people say, oh, that's old-fashioned farming. But we are talking about farming with gadgets like this. Well, agroforestry can utilize gadgets. We need a lot more gadgets, in fact. Our ag engineers should focus on developing tools to make agroforestry even more profitable for landowners. And I think that day is coming. People are talking about designing tools or small equipment for agroforestry. Urban agroforests or food forests, I would call them, they are like the home gardens, but temperate home gardens, all sorts of species mixed together. They are really catching up like wildfire in the US and in Europe also. They are not providing a lot of food, but still whatever food they are producing, it is consumed in that community, in urban centers. So they are contributing a great deal, when you think about it, for food security. Perhaps in inner cities, but still an important function served by these food forests. Introducing trees, for example, as a second crop can also have other benefits. And I'm just showing one example, providing shade and shelter for animals. And you may have seen data like this before. And a lot of companies and producers and consumers alike are really looking for the animal welfare in production systems. You go to Europe, you will see free-range chicken. That is becoming really popular. I just visited a farm in Italy. They are making 3 times more for their meat compared to like the conventional poultry because they have free-range chicken under their olive orchards, a form of agroforestry. It's like poultry silver pasture. Well, I have shown a graph here showing that when the temperature humidity index goes up, milk yield goes down. If you are in animal production, meat or dairy, this is a well-known fact. Just like us, they are also stressed. And their meat production goes down, milk production goes down. In milk production alone, in the U.S., we lose $2 billion annually. And they are talking about providing artificial shade. And these are all the benefits of shading shown in the literature. So it's a well-known fact. Shading helps animals. Then how come we still go after the open pasture as a concept? I don't know. We have all the data, but we are still not worried about providing the shade. Well, silver pasture can help. By putting the trees, providing the shade, the animals benefit. The farmers can make more money. Look at the dollar figure in red there. Per cow calf, you can make almost $110. That is data from Missouri. And for the pasture, grass, it is beneficial. Again, based on our trials. Sorry, I cannot really point this out if I move away from here. It's been sitting here all along. I didn't realize we had it. Anyway, so if you look at pasture growth starts early, under trees, lasts longer, under trees, the pasture grass produces much higher, again look at this in blue, that is under silver pasture compared to the traditional pasture. So in the heat of the summer, you still have the cool season grasses producing more under shade. So overall, pasture production is also very good under shade. And here is something that we summarize after looking at all kinds of functional types like cool season grasses, warm season legumes, cool season legumes. Overall, you can see they don't need 100% light. Even at 45% light, they are reaching their peak biomass production. That means all these different types, you can put them under shade and they will still produce a decent biomass just like in the open. Then why are we not doing it? Well, a lot of people are adopting silver pasture now. They are seeing these benefits. Here is another one. If you look at the crude protein yield, that is biomass times the protein in the foliage, the percentage, you will see that it's actually beneficial to have shading. Under 45% light, you can see that is when it peaked, not under full sun, which is well known. If you provide shading, the crude protein in the foliage will go up. And you can see overall, again, all these different types, cool season grasses, warm season legumes, cool season legumes, irrespective of the type, you get your best performance, biomass and crude protein content or yield under shade. Makes sense. We don't need the open pasture. Here is a success story from a local farmer in Missouri who tried to do that. I'd like to draw your attention to the benefit-cost ratio here, 3.2. Because of the shading, his animals increased weight, and it works in two different ways in Missouri. You get protection from heat in the middle of the summer, but also in the winter, you get protection from the cold weather. So he made $130 more per head because of the shading and the protection he provided by converting an existing forest into a silver pasture. So it goes both ways. You can go from a forest to a silver pasture or from a pasture to a silver pasture by putting more trees. Agroforestry is also a flexible land use to accommodate biomass production. There is a lot of interest in biomass production. It's gone down slightly, but still, talk to DOE or USDA, they are still investing, and we are still hopeful that one day we will see liquid fuels out of cellulosic biomass. But making pellets for European markets has already become a major business in the southeastern United States. Here is an example from the southeast, alley cropping practiced at an industrial scale by Weyerhaeuser, where they are growing switchgrass in between loblolly pine. You can still grow like hardwoods with sorghum as a biomass crop. This is from Canada, where they are growing hardwoods with willow as an alley cropping. These are willow bales actually for biomass use. So agroforestry is flexible. You can actually grow biomass even in a riparian system. If you follow the Iowa State three species model buffer with a grass, a shrub, and a tree, you can have switchgrass or native grasses like that. You can have willows as a biomass crop or cottonwood as a biomass crop. So all of this can be harvested and sold in the market for biomass, for pellets or for liquid fuel when that market evolves. So farm diversification is not just for making more money. It is also for making the farm resistant to all these extreme weather events, but also to make it resilient so it comes back following the bad weather. Well, this is all good farmland, but now underwater because of an intentional breach of a levee in Missouri. 130,000 acres were flooded as a result. You can see the pictures before and after flooding. You can see the extent of the flood. One thing that we learned was, based on the research at the University of Missouri, if you had tree buffers between the river and the levee, this narrow line is the levee and this green represents the buffer, the levee could be protected. So again, the benefit of planting trees on an agricultural field, if you are vulnerable, you need a buffer. And we showed that this wouldn't happen if you had a 500 feet buffer like a riparian zone. Look, all the trees still standing. Most of these are poplar. Well, so you can see a resilient farmscape even after the flood. Of course, all the crops were lost, but the trees were still standing. Kind of an insurance against a natural calamity like this. Well, farm diversification also enhances ecosystem services. And this is a figure that all of you have seen before. Agroforestry has globally the greatest potential to sequester carbon of all the managed ecosystems. And IPCC says so. If you look at the US picture, we can improve or increase carbon density on our landscape very easily by putting more trees on the landscape. And I just gave some numbers here, but there is potential. We estimated, and some of it is real numbers, but some of it is just a guesstimate about the potential area under agroforestry. We tried to look at of these practices, silver pasture, alley cropping, windbreaks, and riparian buffers, what would be the potential for carbon sequestration in the U.S., and we concluded that it's quite a bit. But this is by including all the grazed forest. If you subtract that, the number is much smaller, but it is still substantial compared to some of the other managed ecosystems like managed forest or croplands or pasture. So, agroforestry could offset the current U.S. emissions by 13% if you look at this small number, or up to 34%. But it shows as an exercise the potential to increase carbon density on our landscape by putting more trees on our farmscape, mostly in the Midwest. Speaking of the Midwest, water quality is a major problem. If you look at the hypoxic zone in the Gulf of Mexico, it keeps growing every year. Well, 80% of the phosphorus contributing to this problem is coming from the Midwest landscape. 70% of the nitrogen is coming from the Midwest landscape. Well, can agroforestry help? Of course, we know, because we have data. It's nothing new. We can cut down nitrogen by 80%, phosphorus by 93%. We have all this data. But we need to make these agroforestry practices happen on the landscape. Farmers are still unwilling to sacrifice their land to put in a buffer like this. But what we need to show is this can be a productive area. So we just started a trial in Missouri where, well, for that we had to wait for almost 2 years to find the landowner willing to dedicate a little bit of land. But finally we got somebody, but we are trying to put in species that can be productive, where they can actually make money out of this area, perhaps more money than the farm, the entire farm itself, if you plant the right species like the chestnuts or the pecans or the elderberries. So we are working on a trial like that in collaboration with a landowner at this point. Here is something that you probably didn't know, but by putting trees on a pasture, they can also help with a lot of other environmental concerns like antibiotics. We use a ton of antibiotics for our animal production systems. Well, 80% of the antibiotics that we administer to the livestock can come through the other end. And then where does it go? Into the soil. And then from the soil into the water. So it is a major water quality concern. But look at this figure here. If you have the right trees planted on that pasture, either scattered or as a buffer, it can cut down the antibiotics substantially. Sulfamethoxine, as an example here, look at the blue versus the red line. The blue line is the control where the blue line is the control without the trees, and the red line is with poplar. You can see it takes about 2 weeks, roughly about 12 days, for the antibiotics to disappear in the soil. If you only have the grasses, let's say you introduce the tree, in 5 days, the antibiotics disappears. What's happening? The microbial communities associated with the root systems of those trees were utilizing the antibiotics as their source of energy, their food. So they are disintegrating that, you know, much faster than the microbial communities in the root systems of the grasses. So, a great benefit of silver pasture. Agroforestry for air quality. The different colors show, you know, the concentration of CAFOs, confined animal feeding operations. If you have gone by one, you will notice it because it stinks. The odor is very awful. Well, even if you drive by one of them, you will notice it. So we have, of course, the Midwest, but also along the East Coast and West Coast, we have a great concentration of them in many places. Well, VEBs, these are windbreaks, they can actually cut down the odor quite a bit. Let me show you that through this data. Well, we used a lot of gadgets to figure that out, but here is the final model that we came up with. If you look at these two figures, you will notice the difference. Here, without the VEB, here with the VEB. So with the vegetative environmental buffer or windbreak, you can see that the spread is not as wide like in this picture here. It's cut off like right around there. That means odor is not really spreading far and wide because the VEB is cutting it down. And if you look at the number here, a 27% reduction in ammonia, which is one of the major odor-causing gases. Agroforestry for biodiversity. There is a lot of emphasis for pollinators, for habitat, and look at all these scattered woodlots, typical for Midwest or anywhere, or in many places in the U.S. You put some riparian buffer, all of a sudden you are increasing the efficient size of that habitat quite a bit. Well, agroforestry, it's well proven. But then, with all the data, all the proof, where are all the practitioners? It's happening, but first of all, we need to educate the landowners, but we also need to educate the policymakers. It's happening. I've seen changes happening in the last two decades when it comes to agroforestry adoption quite a bit, to realize not only the individual benefits, but also benefits all the way, like at the global scale, like carbon, water, can all be at a much larger scale than the individual farm. Well, the momentum is building, and I will just show you some of the signposts. Young farmers are interested in diversifying their farms because their farms are much smaller. They are trying to make a living from 50 acres, 20 acres, rather than 500 acres. Older farmers are also looking for diversifying farms using perennial crops because, as I showed you earlier, they are getting to the 60s and 70s. They don't have a lot of energy left to go out there, work every day on the land. They are looking for perennial crops that plant it, forget it. Then you keep harvesting after a few years. Biomass and bioenergy markets are emerging. Carbon markets. Agroforestry's role in conservation is well recognized now. And growing interest in all of these things, like local food, organic food, urban food forests, that's propelling the adoption of agroforestry. And also, at least if you are recognizing that agroforestry can be a good thing for rural America. Well, here is another reason why we believe agroforestry is gaining momentum, especially among young farmers. We started an online master's in agroforestry. The numbers are just exponentially going up. In just 5 years, we admitted over 75 students with 21 graduates. And just about a month ago, the program was ranked number one in the category of environmental sciences in the U.S. Well, thanks to our graduates and the good word that they are spreading about our program, I think, and something related to this particular society here. We did a survey of all the certified crop advisors, the CCAs, about their interest in having a professional certification for agroforestry. Guess what? We found 25% people supporting the creation of agroforestry as a certification within the society. Why? They are hearing it from their landowners. They are asking questions about agroforestry. They are interested in helping their landowners. They see a potential opportunity there. So 25% of them are interested in having some sort of a professional certification for agroforestry. Another good sign that agroforestry is gaining momentum, perhaps even in mainstream agriculture. So in conclusion, I would borrow this from former Secretary Vilsack. We should support agroforestry as a land management approach because it helps landowners achieve certain natural resources goals like clean water and productive soils. Well, I will add to that, which will lead to economic and environmental prosperity of our country. But much work still remains, not only in research, but in making agroforestry a mainstream land use practice as part of a multifunctional working landscape for the right reasons. Thank you.